this week in the markets. Gold and silver posted an impressive rebound, catching sellers off guard, while the Dow Jones Industrials continued a five-week winning streak. Well, welcome back to Gold Seek Radio. Your host, Chris Walczyk, here with you, Season 14, Episode 680. For the third straight year, the New England Patriots will be in the Super Bowl. That's with five-time Super Bowl champ Bill Belichick. The Patriots are in position for their second Super Bowl win in 3 years and third in 5 years. Washington Redskins are the unfortunate targets here, I guess you might say. Super Bowl 53 will play on February 3rd in Atlanta. And speaking of Super Bowls, every week is a Super Bowl for investors and the champs this week. Clearly, the precious metals traders. Investors turn back to the metals ahead of next week's FOMC meeting, where the odds of a rate hike virtually nil. That pulled out support from underneath the greenback, encouraging gold traders. The yellow metal finished at the highest weekly close in 6 months, with silver showing signs of life. Joining me on the topic, Bill Murphy, our good friend from Gata.org, returns with his insights on the sector. We discuss palladium and just how this auto manufacturing has soared over the last year. And we discuss just how silver has a much more inelastic demand, more industrial applications. What happens if China or India, or frankly, any of the 1% decides to corner the silver market? And then platinum, palladium's sister metal, is about $500 less expensive than palladium and just as worthy of industrial application. How long before the Asian manufacturers see this big opportunity? It wouldn't take the BRICS nations themselves, just one of their colleagues, to send the metals soaring. Then on to Factum Blockchain CEO Paul Snow makes his show debut. One of the founders of the blockchain revolution, they built Factum from the ground up. And for my Internet of Things investors, of course, Factum is of particular interest, where the blockchain is used to help secure today everything from homeland security to, frankly, every device in your home or office. The IoT network possibilities are virtually endless to protect all of us from spoofing and other sophisticated hacks. You can listen to CEO Snow talk about his Merkle tree algorithm that embeds directly right into the Ethereum and Bitcoin blockchain every 10 minutes. And then the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. You can direct your questions to any of my guests if you like, and we'd like to field your questions and comments. Just jot this down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone, 641-715-3900. Call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mailbox number 514049. Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear talk. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector this week. As the stronger yuan pushed the greenback lower, investors sought out U.S. dollar alternatives in the precious metals sector. At Friday's closing bell, gold was up $16, finishing at around $1,300. Silver was up about 2%, 30 cents, finishing at $1,570, while the XAU precious metals shares finished at $71, adding 3 for the week. Black gold finished near break-even at $53.70, and palladium, after touching $1,400 last week, was off just $15 at $13.20. Its sister metal, platinum, on our must-watch metal list, added 2%, $16 this week, finishing at $8.18. The top story driving the precious metals sector: gold futures settled above $1,300 an ounce on Friday, at the highest level since last June, as the U.S. dollar pulled back amid continued global recession fears and geopolitical instability. Traders turned to safe haven investments amid the longest U.S. government shutdown in history on news that the two bills to end the partial shutdown failed to pass in the Senate. 800,000 federal workers remain out of work or working without pay. Flights delayed at four major airports due to staffing issues, Elsewhere, the People's Bank of China has injected a record $83 billion to boost its economy, with zero progress in the trade talks between the two behemoths, the U.S. and China. Negotiations have stalled, particularly given the controversy surrounding the extradition of Meng Wanzhou, Huawei's chief financial officer, who's currently being detained in Canada. The news pushed the U.S. dollar off a three-week high ahead of next week's Fed meeting, where clearly rates will be held steady. The current Fed funds futures suggest no change in the benchmark overnight lending rate, with 99.5% probability of holding firm. Clearly, the Fed will pause the rate hiking cycle this year. That's undermining the reserve currency's status. Last week, John Williams, president of the New York Federal Reserve, warned about the domestic economy. And earlier in the month, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell also raised concerns about the U.S. debt levels. Bottom line on precious metals. Clearly, the big story this week was dollar weakness and the stock pause. That increased investors' appetites for gold. We saw that in the holdings of the Spider Gold Trust, largest gold-backed ETF holdings climbed to the highest in about 6 months there. From a technical position, things markedly improved this week, at least in bullion. We'd like to see more strength in the XAU, though. But for the time being, things are looking better. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies remained, with most of the key indexes closing in the black with a five-week winning streak. By Friday's closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow added 30 points near break-even, ending at 24,737, but the S&P 500 gave back just 6 at 26,65, also near the break-even point. The Nasdaq gained 8 points, finishing at 71,65, and the Bitcoin ETF GBTC continued to give back a little bit, 3.5%, finishing at around 420. It appears to be just holding by its fingertips above support. In related news, the risk-off trade was the mantra echoing in the halls of Wall Street on news that the International Monetary Fund warned of a global economic slowdown following less savory numbers from China. The country registered its lowest growth rate in 3 months. In the World Economic Outlook report, the IMF predicts the global economy will slow this year, noting the trouble in Europe with the Brexit situation, as well as escalating geopolitical uncertainty around the world. Meanwhile, CNBC's Jim Cramer, noted market rotation. He directed investors to use the rebound in U.S. shares as an opportunity to rotate out of safe haven stocks into faster growing plays. The process could take some time, presenting ample opportunities. The prophet of profits advocated safe food and drug stocks and moving into faster growing shares like semiconductor plays. He noted Texas Instruments and Lam Research still seem cheap. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, the USA Today Greed to Fear Index remained in the greedy category for the second week running, suggesting the herd now has probably entered back into this market. We're seeing some technical signs that we're up against solid resistance. So for the time being, I'm going to remain in the neutral camp. I don't see any reason to rush back in after a five-week epic rally. I'd rather wait and see what type of reaction unfolds in the coming weeks. And coming up after the break, more Gold Seek.
It's a pleasure to welcome a new guest on his debut appearance today, brought to us by Kyle Heineman, the Factum Protocol. Factum uses a distributed ledger and essentially allows for a chronological ordering in the blockchain, efficient storage and retrieval. Paul Snow, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good, thanks. And I understand you're in the Austin area.
Oh, yeah, we're suffering here, you know, 60-degree temperatures in the frigid winter. It's just terrible.
Before we jump into the Factum blockchain, let's start off with your background. You can tell listeners a bit more about your work with Factum, as well as founder of the Texas Bitcoin Conference.
Okay, well, certainly. I'm an engineer. I got my undergrad in Louisiana, did some work with Texas Instruments for a short period of time, figured out that I was not really psychologically in tune to building bombs. Went to graduate school at Texas A&M. Texas A&M, I got involved with compilers and interpreters, as well as the digital printing revolution, largely in the form of PostScript. And PostScript is a printing language that allows you to describe a page in a resolution independent fashion. It is the technology behind PDFs. Your PDFs are actually PostScript files. Then I did a bunch of other things, some embedded systems, some even children's software, worked on Outlook a bit for Microsoft, and even had some IBM exposure. But I ended up landing in Texas, where I wrote a rules engine for the state of Texas to evaluate eligibility determination for Health and Human Services assistance programs, Medicare, Medicaid, TANF, SNAP, all these programs that they have. That rules engine used decision tables. It used a very, very deterministic definitions and processing, allowed subject matter experts to write the rules instead of developers. And it's, after 18 years, is still in use here in Texas and in Michigan. And I was doing work on that sector for most of the 2000s, building rules engines for policy and that sort of stuff. And somewhere around 2010, 2011, I started to pay attention to this weird thing called Bitcoin that I had picked up on Slashdot. And I bought my first Bitcoin at 75 cents.
Oh, no.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't buy enough at 75 cents, but certainly enough that I've been very happy. I do recall in 2012 coming in and sitting down on the bed and telling my wife that I may have inadvertently funded our retirement. It was a fascinating thing. 2013, I just really got on board. Unfortunately, I waited till 2013 to really look the tech behind the tech, and so it was then that I became a kind of a believer in what Bitcoin does and what the currency movement can do, and I started a meetup. In 2013, I'm still running the meetup more or less today. Toward the end of 2013, I started getting interested in having speakers and bringing in people to talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general, all the projects that were coming up, all the distributed autonomous applications. And that led to our meetup and myself forming the Texas Bitcoin Conference. Business being business, I've ended up shepherding the Texas Bitcoin Conference. The last one was last October. We still keep a meetup and a community influence in on the conference. So I was approached by David Johnston to figure out how to build distributed autonomous applications on the blockchain. In 2014, there was an investor, David Johnston, who came to me and pushed me to develop a platform for distributed autonomous applications, and you know, to pick a distributed autonomous application to build. And I started out with the idea of software registration, so that you have trusted computing, you know exactly what your software you're executing and how you're configuring your systems. That led me very quickly to the observation that I needed to have identity. I needed to know what the projects were, who the developers were, what the releases were, and basically manage the whole provenance of software and all the parties involved. The dirty little secret about the world today is that all the data that we have in our systems, we have almost no proof of the origin of the data, of the provenance of that data, or even proof that the data hasn't been modified somewhere along the way. And if I'm trying to create absolute proof that the software I'm installing in a system is exactly the software that I intended to install from the parties that I have some trust in, that have reputation, then there needs to be not only identity, but a, you know, cryptographic proof, you know, basically allow entities and or identities to actually sign and put their name behind artifacts in a ongoing fluid process. When I looked at that problem and looked at how to put it onto the blockchain, I realized that I needed something like Factum. And so we built Factum. Factum is a data layer for the blockchain. It's designed to provide the provide for the needs of a distributed autonomous protocol. In other words, it has a token that incentivizes people to work in the system, as well as provide for the needs of enterprise usage. And in which case it has a two token system where you burn the tradable tokens into entry credits that have a fixed USD value and are not tradable. And the idea is an entity can buy entry credits from the protocol and use the protocol without ever touching the tradable token that might lead to regulatory issues or security issues or even tax reporting issues.
It sounds as though you have, of course, the security token, and then there's a utility token that instead of proof of stake, it's proof of work.
Yeah, we use this proof of use is really what it boils down to. You've converted something tradable and has a real world asset into something that has a fixed market cost, but doesn't have any tradable value because you can't trade it. It can't be put on an exchange. You can't give it to someone else. About the only thing you can do is give them your private keys. That doesn't stop you from burning the same token. So it's not a tradable thing. We assert that our token running as a coin of the realm is still a utility token and not a security. But as far as the parties using the protocol, they are completely in the clear because they never touch a token that is tradable. Therefore, you can't call something a security if you can't trade it or sell it or buy it.
Can you tell us a bit more about the burning process, like an Ethereum gas? Is that somewhat similar?
It is similar. And the early designs of Ethereum were looking at a two-token system where you would have Ether and then you would have gas tokens. Gas became just a way of getting your head around the fees involved. Gas doesn't actually exist in Ethereum as a token. In our case, the Factoid is the tradable token. The entry credit is the non-tradable token. You can think of entry credits as prepaid fees, or you can think of them as forever stamps, in the sense that a entry credit allows you to write a entry, the smallest entry into Factum, which is 1K, up to 1K. So you can write a 1K entry for effectively a tenth of a cent.
Would you like to present to our neophytes and folks who are just maybe learning about the blockchain technology, the transparency, the immutability, privacy, as well as real-world practical solutions that the Factum blockchain brings as a decentralized platform?
Certainly, on a newbie level or you know, looking at the blockchain, there's a lot of questions that come up. A lot of people say, well, I can do all that. You know, pick an application. I can do all that in using today's current technology. Why do I need a blockchain? Almost always a blockchain is needed to create that immutable ledger, which an immutable is the $10 word to say that you can't change it once you've written it. So think of it as you're writing an application in ink. You know, you don't get to erase the ink, right? And so But unlike that application, you can't even cross anything out in the blockchain. Once it's written, it's there. Now, that doesn't mean that you cannot put in a transaction to correct. So, for instance, if I paid for something with Bitcoin from a merchant and I appeal to the merchant that they didn't produce the product, that merchant can send me a refund. What they can't do is pretend the transaction didn't occur, because the transaction to pay them is on the blockchain and the transaction to send them money back is also on the blockchain. You know, as an introduction to the neophytes and maybe an example that everyone can relate to is the meltdown for the mortgage-backed securities in 2008 and 2009, because what happened was very low cost or very risky loans were packaged into securities and marked up as being AAA type assets and sold in the market, and they weren't. And anybody who's watched The Big Short realizes, you know, the games that were played, and then it all melted down. The interesting thing is there were trillions of dollars of value that disappeared, largely due to systemic fraud and systemically bad processes. And what we want to do with the blockchain is ensure that the processes at each step along the way, in the loan origination process, the loan evaluation process, the loan packaging process, that there are actual names put to, you know, reputations put to each step in the process. And the blockchain is essential to this, because you can't rely on all the individual players to maintain their records, because this was one of the things we found out when we started investigating after the meltdown.
Yes, exactly. The subprime meltdown, the Alt-A's, and the Ninja loans.
Yeah, but exactly to your point, because nobody's name is on the steps, most of those people got away with it. Very, very few people were fined. I mean, there were some fines handed to banks, you know, on a systemic level, but the exact malfeasance was lost because the record keeping was so bad. And we've now tried to improve the record keeping, but we still have the same technology, the same databases that can be modified, the same difficulty in coordinating different businesses. You know, for example, if a business is keeping really good records, but it happens to be one of the ones that gets crushed and goes out of business, where's the system of record to track the stuff that was in their databases? They've liquidated, they've destroyed their systems, they've shut down the servers. You know, all that data's lost, and it's not possible to transfer the records from one system of record to another system of record in any other fashion other than hearsay.
In comes the fact in blockchain, transparency, and, you know, an easy to find digital trail.
Right. And you can create the digital trails. You can create the hashes. At every step of the way, you can say, do I have all the data? If you have all the data that matches all the hashes within a particular audit trail for a particular process, then you know you have all your data. And by the way, this is not revealing any of this data to the world. It's only cryptographic proof that the data that you have in your system came from another system and has not been modified or changed since that system said this is the data. So you say this is the data, you put the hashes in the blockchain, the next system comes along, they say, give me this process, this loan. Oh, here's 10 hashes, I need 10 documents. The documents match, bingo. I have all the data.
Let's talk about the peer-to-peer network features. I mean, this is interesting. If we take a look at BitShares, proof of stake, that's, I think, rather compelling and a very intriguing platform. You have a system or a network of these servers where the membership is based on the community support and performance of each member.
First off, BitShares is distributed proof of stake. So they use their, but it plays right into some descriptions to elucidate how Factum is built, because that distributed proof of stake is used to record data and in BitShares, and it's proven to be at least stable enough for the system to continue running for, I don't know, probably over 5 years now. The way Factum is constructed is there are a number of servers that are part of an authority set, and those servers become servers because those people that have a standing in the network support them. And the highest supported parties, they're in the authority set, and they run the protocol. This is a bit of a play on distributed proof of a delegated proof of stake like BitShares, because we don't build the blocks with our stake. We elect the parties that build the blocks. So it's, if you think of BitShares as democracy, we're a republic. We have identified parties that are running the system. That means that they have to campaign to the community in order to maintain their standing, to maintain their role as running the system. Furthermore, standing in our system is more complex. We create categories of standing. We are going to allow you to stake tokens, and this is what you do in BitShares. But in addition to that, because we have a separate token for fees, and fees represent the use of the protocol, then the part people that have purchased intracredits have standing based off of that, which we kind of think of as proof of use, because there's almost no reason to burn tokens into a non-tradable, non-fungible asset unless you're using that asset for what it's designed to do, which is use the protocol. We have grants in our system that build infrastructure and successful completion of value in those grants provides standing, as well as efficiency. Those people that are running the protocol, they're budgeted X amount of tokens every month. You know, it's paid out weekly, but at a certain cadence, they are paid tokens for running the protocol. Any amount of those tokens they leave on the table, that is efficiency. They're more efficient. They use fewer tokens to do their work. That efficiency is used as collateral in the system as part of the standing. Anyway, the idea is, because we have these different modes of standing in our system, and those modes are combined kind of like your grade in school with a homework grade and a quiz grade and a test grade and so forth, they're combined in different channels. It means that the protocol is very difficult to attack the way some proof of share or proof of stake systems are attacked by somebody who just throws a bunch of tokens at it. Here you have to throw effort at it. You have to contribute to the community. You have to use the protocol, and you have to stake. And so no one category can rule the system. It's a very social system.
Can you, as we wrap up here today, give our listeners an overview of where you see the Factum blockchain? What's the evolution here, and where will we be in, let's say, 1 to 3 years?
Well, we're increasingly being used to back smart contracts and back infrastructure like IoT infrastructure, medical records distribution, loan origination, any process that tends to be litigious, allowing the parties to document what they're doing. Digital rights management is also big. What we've done here is we've built a general purpose data integrity layer that does not hem the users into a particular way of looking at their problems. And so in the next 1 to 3 years, we're going to see data integrity as being viewed as more important than it currently is in databases and in the information that different systems collect. And we're going to look at digital identity differently. How do I create a digital identity that actually manages aspects of my identity instead of simply being a trivia contest where anyone who has enough information about you can be you just because they can win the trivia contest? These kinds of radical changes are going to make the system, the world, more intuitive, more secure, more private. Factum is going to play a large role in that.
You did bring up IoT or Internet of Things, and this is an area of keen interest. During a project I participated with Assurant Insurance, it became abundantly clear that there will be an enormous explosion, you might say. I think that's almost an understatement, in this entire new arena where we just have, you know, interoperability between virtually every device, your washing machine, your laptop, your cell phone, your iPhone, your Android, the refrigerator. It's all becoming connected, and then there will be networks within networks. Can you expand just briefly on how the Factum blockchain could be a facilitator in this arena?
Oh, certainly. We went through a lot of these issues working with the Department of Homeland Security, three phases, finishing up the fourth phase of a project to look at how the blockchain can help to secure IoT devices, particularly sensors on the border. Drug runners, human traffickers, all sorts of these people that are crossing the border are very, very sophisticated. You would expect drug gangs who are bringing in literally billions of dollars to have the ability to hire the best technical people to compromise systems. And so what we did was we created strong digital identities for those devices that are being deployed. And we've created strong digital identities for the locations where those devices are deployed. And those mechanisms allow us to prevent someone from spoofing a device, because it's not just replacing the device with the same brand and same physical attributes as the device that they want to move. It also means penetrating a digital identity system backed by cryptography. That is a road too far. It's just too much. And so we can maintain the security of the device that way. In other words, they can replace the device, but the device without the identity will be rejected by the system. And thus we know a device has been taken out. One of their common things is to take a device, point it in another direction, knock out the correct device, and suddenly they've created a blind spot. Spoofing of devices is a real problem for them.
Factum actually anchors its material or entries directly into the Bitcoin blockchain. Am I correct?
No, you're exactly correct. We collect all the data into a Merkle root every 10 minutes, and we write that hash into the Bitcoin blockchain. For people that don't understand Merkle trees, just think of it as a sports bracket, and just like you can watch your favorite team throughout the year, like the Saints and the absolute theft of the last game. I only watch Saints games, but I can still know with confidence that they should have made it to the Super Bowl this year by simply watching the games they played and ignoring everything else. And that's what a Merkle tree does. When you have data that's written into Factum, there's a cryptographic proof that goes to that Super Bowl Merkle tree root that we write into the Bitcoin blockchain. And we're also writing into Ethereum as well. So for a tenth of a cent, you can write data into Factum, and you can have a cryptographic proof against the Bitcoin blockchain that your data has not been modified. I'll make one other point, because I missed this when we were talking about proof of share. One of the reasons we do anchoring, by the way, we were the project that coined the term anchoring. The reason we do anchoring is that the historical past is best proven with proof of work, because it proves so many systems agreed or saw the information that you have printed, just like putting a hash into the New York Times proves that that hash existed at a particular time. This means that the historical record can't be changed. And one of the problems with distributed proof of stake is reconstructing stake through the historical record is very hard. Counting zeros in a hash is very easy. That's how you define the proof of work. And so mathematically, this is how we secure the blockchain.
Right. Thank you for that clarification. And, you know, for our budding developers, this Factum blockchain was built from the ground up. Would you like to share some contact information and anything else you'd like to leave with the listeners, please?
Well, our website is factum.com, and we have a Reddit that's very active at that's basically Factum is the subreddit on Reddit. Factum is FATCOM. And the first or the pegged entry at the top gives you links to all kinds of information about Factum, the Factum protocol of Factum Inc., the company that I happen to work for. We're only one of 25 companies that are running the protocol. So go to Reddit, look at all the links, and find all this huge amount of information about our system and our protocol.
CEO Paul Snow, we're going to look forward to hearing more about the Factum blockchain, the entire project. Please keep us updated. If you have anything else, maybe pass it along to Kyle so we can set up an interview.
Absolutely. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, we have Bill Murphy back from Dallas. Of course, we had Paul Snow from Factum Blockchain in Austin yesterday. So welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
And thanks for being our first video guest. All right, Bill Murphy, we were talking before the show extensively about the markets. You remain convinced that once investors realize that it's not just U.S. shares that are important, but they've got to balance those portfolios, there might be a mad dash to gold and silver. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, I think the risk-reward in gold and silver right now is as good as at any time in history, and in the sense, to, especially relative to other assets. And, you know, I might have been talking about this gold cartel for 20 years now, and they're at it again like crazy, especially the past few weeks. I mean, they stopped gold above 1290, something like 15 times in a row. Silver finally woke up after a horrible year last year. Now they're at it again, and it's lifeless. But it's leading to price explosions, which I think are coming. And all we can do is monitor the action and look for a change. I mean, we'll see. But there's no doubt in my mind what we have coming down the road, and it's probably going to occur out of nowhere.
Let's talk about price explosions. We've recently seen one, obviously, in palladium. I guess the official mantra out there and the blogosphere is that, well, China has cornered the market as their manufacturers need palladium, right, for catalytic converters in their gas-powered engines. And we've just seen it soar as high, actually briefly above gold, you know, parity with the yellow metal. That's pulled back, as you noted before the show. However, what's to stop China and India, by the way, the fastest growing country now. In fact, the 10 largest cities as far as population growth are all in India right now. What's to stop one of these major Goliaths from cornering something like AG, silver?
Well, you know, as far as palladium goes, I'm no expert. From what I know, it has something to do with Russia curtailing supplies and some strikes in South Africa, and all clicked into the other stuff which you mentioned. But yes, platinum surprised people. And I think it's a good predictor of what silver is going to do at some point down the road, because it's been so maligned for so long. I mean, you know, $15 silver in the year 2019. I mean, I never could have imagined it, if, you know, after 2011. So I think once silver gets above 21, which is a ways away now, it's just going to explode and go to 50 and then 100 faster than most people think, and will trade just like palladium did. And all. One of the easiest reasons is kind of what you alluded to. Somebody can go in and corner the supply, and if you're a product user of silver in your whatever, you know, business you're in, you have to have it whether the price is 15, 30, or 80. You got to have it. And it's liable to cause a panic. And that's what I think is going to help spur this silver price explosion, which has been delayed, but still coming.
Yeah, it's a solid point. You're referring to the price inelasticity of silver. I mean, it's well known that when you need it, you must have it in manufacturing, not to mention as a strategic stockpile. I wonder, though, if you think that there might be some of the quantitative tightening entering this game at some point. I mean, the Fed, they seem to be a little more dovish. They're reversing course on the rate hike cycle. Is that even worth discussing, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah, certainly worth discussing. But then you got to go back, you know, to look at, we've had all this quantitative easing. Look what it did to gold and silver. Gold and silver took off. And silver up to near 50 in 2011, gold above 1900 in September, and then they just went into a control plan to kill the prices for the following, you know, 7-8 years. And what did it all mean in the end? What mattered what the gold cartel was going to do? The quantitative easing was so. For me, these are all important factors which will eventually matter. But in the short term, it's what these bad guys, this gold cartel, can get away with to suppress the prices and take them off the investment radars. Finally broke out for a tiny bit above 159 and showed some signs of life and nice base, and now it's back wobbling around 150. And I know, talking from other people in the industry, that they're calling up, you know, investment people, and there's just no real interest in promoting them. There hasn't been any discoveries in a long time, and these poor littler companies are just struggling. I mean, their prices of them are into oblivion state in many cases. And I know you discussed earlier that gold's really gone up in price because of the dollar situation in many, many other places. But it hasn't affected the interest in the gold silver shares in the United States. It's really dead. Yes, do I expect it to change? Oh, big time. But it hasn't. And it's partly because other assets have done so well these past many years. And as I say, I mentioned in the stock market, it corrects and it goes back up. Then you have another correction. Looks like that's it. Nope, right back up again.
And it's certainly not helped the risk-averse assets like the precious metals and some of the safe haven assets. However, there's a lot more money, I think you'd agree, swishing around in these markets today. And when that trend reverses, you know, it's going to look for a home. That capital, deep pockets, will not be terribly, I think, impressed with extremely overpriced and bubbly treasuries. Could that be what sparks the next bull leg up?
Well, that's a great point about all the money out there now compared to years ago. And it's so much greater. And you're absolutely correct that when it focuses on the tiny gold and silver markets, you can get some squeezes in there. And that's what I'm getting back to, the bad guys running out of physical gold and silver. Yes, that's coming. And I think that's going to be the big surprise when all the money, you know, goes our way, which is why the plunge protection team keeps showing up and making sure the market goes back up. And as we know by now, after what Mnuchin did in December, near Christmas time, I mean, he said it publicly, we're bringing in the plunge protection team and the stock market's going straight up. And of course, the gold cartel is not allowed to even be discussed by anybody except God and a few others in our camp. But they're doing their thing on the sell side in the precious metals.
A recent article pointed out that most of the younger money managers today, which was the bulk of those who were managing money, had never experienced the year 2000 bust, which essentially led to almost a 12-year sideways market of disappointment in U.S. equities. They cut their teeth during 2008-2009, which was just a blip, a drop in the bucket, and then the markets turned right back around and off to new highs. Do you think that they might get caught flat-footed without portfolio assurance, that free portfolio assurance that we've been pounding the table on?
Well, again, another good point. I think, as I said, everybody gets complacent. We all, you know, creatures of habit, and you get used to things happening, and then, you know, people, like, for example, in our given warning about the stock market debacle, and this is coming, and this, all reasons, good stuff, it never happens. And so people go, they stop listening, and because it hasn't done them any good. And then, of course, then you get complacent, and then all of a sudden you get the move down, and instead of getting the standard move up after a correction, it keeps on going, and people just can't believe what's happening. That's how markets are, and that's probably coming yet again. And the guys in our camp that are bearish and making these calls are eventually going to be very right, but they've been way too early, and that's still the case.
That's an extremely valid point. All right, Bill Murphy, you've given us plenty of food for cogitation today. Why don't you tell people a bit more about La Metropole Cafe and Gata.org, the great stuff you're doing there?
Well, thanks, Chris. I've been at it 20 years. People can sign up for a two-week free trial at www.lametropolecafe.com to see if it's of interest. And then my colleague Chris Powell is out there fighting the good fight, and he can be found at www.gata.org. He does a great job, and we're going to stay at it till we get this scheme, as we call it, the manipulation suppression, really exposed to the point where it makes a difference in the markets.
Bill Murphy, we've taken up way too much of your time. You've been a fantastic sport today. Thank you so much.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. Goldseek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. When I was beginning my professional career in the mid-1980s, a sage piece of knowledge or insight was shared with me by one of my mentors who was personal friends with one of the nation's top lawyers at that time. The lawyer had shared what are typically unspoken professional insights with my friend, who had asked him why attorneys seem to often represent what may be perceived as the good clients on one day and the not-so-good clients on other days. He said it was money. Pure and simple. In other words, he said, I'm with this person or that organization today because they're the ones that are paying the bills. Tomorrow, he said, I may be over there because on another day, those individuals might be the ones paying the bills. There are no white knights, nothing principled about it. Allegiances change based on who's paying the bills at any given point in time. Everything else is often just an illusion or wishful thinking. It's not just attorneys who are hired guns. PR and political opposition firms are the same. So are politicians, crisis actors, paid protesters, media personalities, reporters, and the list goes on and on. Shakespeare was correct when he said all the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players who have their exits and entrances. Those exits and entrances range from everyday bit parts that create the interactions and backdrop of daily life, to the major chapters with more prominent casts of characters that often define the peaks and valleys, accomplishments and crises, and the victories and defeats that define the rich tapestry of each of our lives. When you watch the changing allegiances, unpredictable alliances, and surprising endorsements that are common in business, in politics, and other facets of life, remember, the invisible hidden drivers that are battling for your mind, your approval, and your support are often driven by circumstances that you will never know for sure. Except that the person or organization you are looking to for guidance is now with him or her, because they're the ones that are now paying the bills, or at least promising to do so. But every once in a while, you'll discover someone or some organization that is different. When you do, cherish them, respect them, and understand that collecting those kinds of friends and support mechanisms are the reward that makes the world go round. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Thank you.